I will make this announcement again that this is our first time guest, Paul Stamets, author of many, many books, Mycomedicinal, Psilocybin Mushrooms of the World, Growing Gourmet and Medicinal Mushrooms, and The Mushroom Cultivator, as well as Mycelium Running, How Mushrooms Can Help Save the World. We're going to get into some stuff about mycoremediation. I'm wondering how much remediation is possible. I think I heard a rumor about a diesel spill where mushrooms were instrumental. I want to know how long people have been carrying these things around. And I believe that I heard that one of them will even hold heat or fire for a rather long period of time. They're remarkable. And if I understand what Paul Stamets was saying, the reason we have soil is because the universe has got nothing but time. And if it takes that long for the mushrooms to break down the rocks and create soil, well, I guess if it takes a few hundred thousand years, so what? Plenty more where that came from in an infinite universe. We'll be back with Paul in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, Paul, let's recapitulate here for just a moment. Explain to, I don't mean to seem like a dunderhead here, but just explain what the monoculture, what does that really mean to we individual earthlings, and why should we beware of it?
Well, a classic example, even though I am academically trained, I believe in the school of hard knocks, and I was a blue-collar worker working in the sawmills and the shingle mills. And then, you know, when I was around 21 years of age, I went into the woods, you know, as a logger and set chokers and did that for 2 years until three guys in my crew got killed, and then I decided to go back to college. But
gotcha.
The clear cutting, you know, in the view of forestry has been to treat forests as if they're cornfields, and that's a monocrop. You would cut them all down and replant them all in 1 year, and you wouldn't have this multi-stage canopy growth you would see in the native forests. And so as a result of clear cutting, and going back to the soil that I was talking about that was built up in the past 10,000 years. And so I'm setting chokers in the woods, and the root wads are only 3 feet deep, and they're 20 to 40 feet across, and these trees are, you know, 200 feet tall. It's just amazing. The roots were so shallow. And then we cut down the trees, and I'm sitting in the brush a lot, and I'm thinking, well, I can see where all the carbon's going. We were doing three log loads. These are three trees to a logging truck, and these are massive trees. And so I was actively involved in killing the old-growth forest. And then, the trees would be cut. So let's go back into about 1900, when the old-growth trees were everywhere. And so you cut down the trees, and they would be taken away, and then they would burn. So there's two withdrawals from the carbon bank. Now, the carbon bank was built over 10,000 years. So around 1900, whatever, you know, the Northwest here, the first cut of the old-growth trees, and they would cut, and then they would burn. Two withdrawals from the carbon bank. And they go to 1950, you know, 50 years later approximately, we have a second cut. And what they do, they'd cut the trees, and then they'd haul them away, and they'd burn again, all the brush. So three, four withdrawals from the carbon bank. We go to the year 2000, and we have another cut, a third cut. You know, same thing happens. Five, six withdrawals from the carbon bank, and 100 years, that took 10,000 years for that soil base to be built. You know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to see that we have a much higher withdrawal from the carbon bank than that which we are contributing to it. So that's an example of monoculture. And as a result, the soils have thinned, and now you're getting what's called premature decline. Now, premature decline is when trees are toppling over because the root wads can't be strong enough to hold the trees. So the logging industry and the economists that are working for them look at the trees and go, we have to cut them before they get blown down or get diseased. And so you have diseases now proliferating in these third, fourth generation cut forests. Soils are thinning, the yields are declining, and so the logging companies are selling this off as real estate because they know they're not getting the yield of return of board feet of timber. Now that, I think, is the wrong economic metric. We should be looking at ecological metrics, because the contribution of a forest cleans water. You can, you know, these cloud forests capture so much moisture, and as a result, the watersheds are protected. Seattle, Washington has a fantastic watershed because the city bought the old growth forest from the logging companies before it was logged. And so as a result, we have a fantastic reservoir system of fresh water. Well, had that forest been cut in the way that I just described, that watershed would not be there. We wouldn't have enough water for Seattle. But this segues, I think, nicely into something I have dedicated my life to, helping the old growth forest, and I know it well. Some of my best friends were loggers. Some of the best environmentalists I know were loggers, little contrary to what people think, but they wanted to protect their steelhead streams for their kids and their grandkids, you know. They were very upset when the ecosystem was destroyed around the nature that they enjoyed recreationally after work. But I became involved. We have a very eclectic culture collection. We have about 500 strains of fungi in culture. We have very large laboratories here. We live in a place called Community Point, Washington, south of Seattle at the base of the Olympic Peninsula, very close to the old growth forest. So my wife and I have a great team here, and we are dedicated hikers. We go into the old growth forest, and we try to get into culture rare strains of mushrooms before the ecosystem is destroyed by logging, for instance. They are still logging old growth forests. When I was logging, the logs were going to Japan to make toothpicks, if you can believe that. Toothpicks out of old growth forests, you know. Our culture collection became of interest to the U.S. The U.S. Defense Department directly after 9/11, because we have a large culture library. And I wrote two articles in a peer-reviewed journal, Novel Antivirals for Mushrooms and Novel Antimicrobials for Mushrooms. It was a literature review, basically, of all the scientific research that has been published to date on novel activities of mushrooms against viruses and bacteria. A whopping 3 to 4 pages each. That's how little information was known. And I thought, well, this has not been explored very well. Then after 9/11, the biggest concern the U.S. government had by far was weaponizable viruses. They could track radioactive metals, you know, and because of their emissions, and that was much more controllable. But viruses don't care about borders. They can be one person can transmit to hundreds of other people. And the exponential pandemic that can be created from that is something that is horrific. So the U.S. the BioShield Biodefense Program, which is a triangular relationship between NIH, DOD, and U.S. AMRID, U.S. Army Research Institute, of infectious diseases, they contacted me and they said, you know, you're welcome to submit samples to the BioShield Biodefense Program to see if you have any activity against viruses, and particularly pox viruses. Smallpox was a big concern. The Russians had smallpox. The U.S. government and some other countries do. I went to Russia. I went into one of the laboratories that had smallpox. It was literally in an old, like, 1950s refrigerator that had one of the locks on you used to have in high school, you know, that could kick it off. The sure. windows were broken. There were pigeons flying into the building, literally. This is in 1994. You know, I was horrified. And then, you know, I was given information that smallpox was sold to Al-Qaeda. Hopefully the pox viruses were dead in the test tubes because their storage was so pitiful. But we submitted over 500 samples of our mycelium growing in the laboratory into the BioShield Biodefense Program. We sent off these samples, didn't hear for a while, and then it was actually kind of a funny story because then the Federal Express delivered me a package, a very thick package with a few hundred research reports from the samples that we sent. And I'm flipping through these samples, and no activity, no activity, no activity. I get the sample 76, and well, lo and behold, active, then highly active against orthopoxes, including smallpox. And I got real excited, and I thought, this is fantastic. And I was given a contact in the U.S. military, a colonel. And I called him up saying, these results are fantastic. I'm so excited. And he said, what results? I said, the results I just got delivered via Federal Express. And he goes, you're not supposed to get those results. I am. I said, I'll photocopy them and send them to you. There's a little bit of humor there. He didn't take it that way. But the Bioshield Defense Program was pretty disorganized, you know, because, you know, of course it would be with three government agencies trying to coordinate on something new. But then when I gave them a coded samples, I didn't tell them what species of mushrooms I had sent them in the mycelial form. And I also did fruit of the mushrooms themselves, you know, hot water extracts and ethanol extracts. And I did the same with the mycelium, you know, from which the mushrooms sprang. And then very interestingly, a mushroom that came out on top, highly active, is one called agaricon. Agaricon is a mushroom that grows exclusively in the old growth forest. It does not grow in second growth. It doesn't grow in third growth. So when these clear cuts are made of the forest, destroying biodiversity, this species becomes extinct. And so this agaricon mushroom, it looks like a bee's nest or a wasp's nest. It's very, very big. It's the longest living mushroom in the world. And it can live for up to 100 years in the old growth forest, subjected to hundreds of inches of rain, wind, sleet, hail, and yet it doesn't rot. And so it was. I was attracted to it because it was so rare. And my dear professor, who was my mentor, he found his first agaricon after 40 years of searching in the old growth forest, found his first one last year. Our team now, we have collected 45 strains of agaricon from Northern California, Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia, by far the largest culture collection in the world. And so we had extremely high activity against orthopoxes, and then we started to engage in what's called bioguided fractionation. And this is basically a stepwise sequence of using different solvents to isolate out the active fractions. You know, use water and use DMSO or hexane or different solvents, and you see which pathway of fractionation still had the activity. And working with the University of Mississippi with the Natural Products Program over about 5 or 6 years, we isolated out a new molecule unknown to science that's highly active against pox viruses. So that was really triumphant. We have not published this, but we have a new magic molecule that we isolated from this rare old growth species. And so we have a press announcement that was vetted by DOD. If anyone wants to Google my name, Stamets and Smallpox, they can see a vetted DOD press release. And then National Public Radio interviewed myself, the deputy director of the FDA and the founder of the BioShield program on NPR. Right. And we had the highest activity of any sample, more than 200,000 that were submitted, including mostly pure pharmaceuticals, but we submitted a natural product. And then in the course of these discussions, we found out that we were the highest activity of more than 2 million samples. And because my intuition seemed to be right on, I submitted replicates. And what I mean by that is in samples 72 and 76, 78, were really the same sample, but I thought that this agaricon mushroom, because of its host defensive resistance against pathogens, the longest living mushroom in the world, would likely have this activity, and I was right on. And by submitting replicates, I was able to authenticate the research results from the laboratory because the results came back as the same. And so the BioShield Biodefense Program were very happy that I had done this.
Not because bad.
It authenticated that their research test results were good. Well, those of us after 1960, born after 1968, you know, basically you are what is known as being immunologically naive, which means you have no immune defense against smallpox. People have not been vaccinated for many, many years. So this is a big concern. If smallpox does get out again, we hope that it does not. But by far the virus of concern now are flu, or viruses of concern are flu viruses, especially H5N1. And so,
and you were saying that is actually carried by flies.
Yeah, what many people do not know is that H5N1 bird flu can be transmitted by house flies. So if there was a bird flu pandemic, don't use a fly swatter against your window. And so flies go around diseased chickens, which are immunocompromised, and bird flus carried by chickens. And another example of monoculture in factory farms. These become breeding grounds. And so they have those samples. So when bird flu became such a big concern, we then asked the laboratories to transfer the samples to a different laboratory to test against bird flu. And this is when we hit the big home run. And that agarikon mushroom, the old growth forest, is extremely active against bird flu. We have entered into a period of viral storms. And I met with some people in Washington, D.C. I'm not going to mention the agency that I met with, but I was talking about weaponizable viruses, and they said something that put shivers up and down my spine. They said, Paul, it's no longer a concern of bioterrorism using bird flu. There are so many epicenters of opportunity of bird flu emerging out of nature now that they predict in the next 10 years that a bird flu pandemic is going to occur. And so I was, we were delighted that we had this activity against bird flu that was so powerful. Now, for any scientists out there listening, smallpox is a DNA virus and bird flu is an RNA virus. It is unusual to have one concoction that'll be dually active against both. Typically, those will be toxins. When we did the bioguided fractionation at the University of Mississippi, and we found this magic molecule active against pox viruses, when we sent it to St. Jude Hospital to test it against bird flu, guess what? No activity. That's good news. Because we found that that within this mushroom is resident these a consortium of antiviral compounds that we haven't fully elucidated yet. But we know that there's a different group of molecules that are active against bird flu. So this is a very good argument, which I've been able to make, that we should save the old growth forest as a matter of national defense. If we lose the biodiversity of agarikon in the old growth forest, and we have 45 to 50 strains of agarikon on culture now, some of these are more active against bird flu than others. And so just like you find different molds of like penicillium strains that produce more penicillin than others, this is, the biodiversity of these fungal species is critically important. So, I've been following bird flu epicenters around the world. And on the eastern shore of Japan, and there was three different wild bird flu events on the eastern shore of Japan before the earthquake. And then the earthquake occurred. And now we have a perfect storm. We have a tidal wave and an earthquake, and we have Fukushima. And then it's a perfect storm of dead people, dead pigs, dead birds, and a saline solution and salt water all commingling. And those that have survived are immunocompromised. Nature's a numbers game. And when you're immunocompromised, you're more susceptible for carrying and harboring these viruses, and you can harbor more than one. And so if we have the communicability of H1N1, which we had a few years ago, combined with the lethality of H5N1, which is over 70% fatal, then we are facing a pandemic of historic proportions. And so we became very concerned, and I still am very, very concerned about a bird flu pandemic, which I think is on the near event horizon. It's coming.
And you're talking within a year or two or longer?
I think we'll have it within 10 years. But it's coming because there's too many opportunities now.
The odds basically compel it.
It's compounding odds as time progresses, as habitats are decimated because of chemical pollution, overpopulation, right, factory farms, and this monoculture approach to our food. To our food base.
Gotcha. We got to take another break. I'm telling you, this is going by quickly, Paul. Paul Stamets, our first-time guest tonight. FUNGI.com. Please check it out, and we'll be back as we make our way through the darkness and hopefully to the light. This is Coast to Coast AM. Well, I'll tell you what, it sounds a little bit grim, doesn't it? Remember what Tyler Durden said in one of my favorite little movies, Fight Club? On a long enough timeline, the survival rate goes to zero. However, I have have a feeling that Mother Earth is going to find a way to survive with or without us, and it all apparently began, at least as we know it, with a mushroom. I want to get in some remediation here. I want to find out if there's any light at the end of the tunnel with this pending pandemic. We all know that it's a distinct possibility. In fact, it's darned likely that this will occur. In fact, I just saw a report about some contaminated chickens out of Mexico, and they're definitely contaminated with avian flu. So let's find out. Hey, you know, there's always a flip side of the coin. And there's no point in fear-mongering. You know, just as a side note here, have you noticed how discombobulated, baffled, and otherwise like bumbling and blundering those that we have put in the position to take care of us seem to be lately? I have a feeling I know why that is. I think it's becoming so undeniably, ridiculously obvious that the populace is waking up. I mentioned during some of the programs at the end of 2012 that we were waiting for an awakening, waiting for something to change, something to happen. And I submitted to you that you are the awakening. And I believe that you are the awakening, because the longer you listen, not only the later it gets, but the more you know. And the more you know, the better equipped you are to deal with the future, because it's coming, whether we like it or not. We'll be back with Paul Stamets, the Mushroom Man. A lot of questions for him, and if we have time, we'll take some calls, but we'll let you know when. We'll play the numbers at that time, and we'll be right back. A little two-minute break, please. This is Coast to Coast AM, Saturday Night Edition. You know, Paul Stamets, when we started our chat tonight, I just listened for long periods, and I was thinking, oh, my God, this man is a genius. It's certainly not only probably academically, but also, is there such a word as experientially? And I'm wondering... doesn't this sort of research take an enormous amount of funding, or did you just do it? Did you just get in there and do it yourself?
Well, largely I've done it myself with the help of some very good people. You know, we created a business. I was accepted into 3 graduate schools. I do have a doctorate of science now, but I was accepted into 3 graduate schools, but I married a woman that was 11 years older than me, and she had 3 teenage kids. So I was a young father, 24 years of age, and I couldn't afford to go to graduate school and move the whole family. So I started a little mail order business, you know, and my whole intention to starting the mail order business was to create funding to do research. So it's an artifact and sort of an after consequence that the business was created as a funding vehicle, which we you know, we have funded a lot of research in the course of this. You know, but I do have some sort of good news on the horizon. But since we mentioned Fukushima, I think this is a perfect example, I think, of a teaching moment, something that we didn't intend or expect. My father was a nuclear engineer with Babcock and Wilcox, and he was involved in the storage of nuclear waste. And he's now passed, but I protested against nuclear energy, and my dad was a pro-nuclear guy, so we had lots of debates. But he did say one thing that's hauntingly true. He said, no matter what, son, you cannot store the nuclear waste adjacent to an operating nuclear power plant. If you have a runaway reaction, then those fuel rods will become basically fuel for a runaway reaction. And
well, isn't the waste more radioactive than the spent rods? Are more dangerous than the unspent rods?
Depending on how they're stored. He was involved in vitrification of glass, encasing them in glass, which he thought was the best solution. But, you know, in no nuclear manual, safety manual, did they have an earthquake creating a tsunami that would cause a meltdown. You know, that was not something that they anticipated, and indeed that has occurred. I'm involved with a group of people who have been to Fukushima, and I have very intimate knowledge of what is happening in Japan. And, you know, it's an island country. They can't go anywhere. The government doesn't want to create hysteria. But it's far worse than the public has been told. The Japanese have been very faithful and trusting of their government, and now they're very skeptical, and they're losing that trust. But there are hot spots across Japan. There's millions of gallons of salt water being used to cool the reactor currently. They can't throw the water away. They have to store it. They're scooping up hundreds of tons of soil per day and putting them in the cement bunkers. By doing so, they denude the breadbasket of Japan. And so they're impairing the ecosystem in terms of growing food. And so there's very little recourse, you know, for cleaning up the environment. And as more earthquakes occur, there's actually a xenon glow of they had cameras on the fuel rods, which had melted, and so they had full disclosure to the public, and here's what they look like. But then scientists realized that there was a xenon, a greenish blue glow of light, and they were saying, "What's that?" And of course, that was not a good thing because it shows this reaction is continuing and getting worse. And so they then put the white light, floodlights, in order to diminish the visibility of the xenon glow. But this is an interesting area of research, and I'm involved in it right now in terms of micro-remediation. And one of the teaching moments in history is from Chernobyl. And after Chernobyl, in downwind environment, Ukrainian scientists went and began to analyze in the forest is the foods that people were collecting to consume to see how the radioactive fallout was concentrating. And lo and behold, they found that mushrooms were hyperaccumulating radioactivity. And there's a mushroom called Gomphidius glutinosus, the hideous Gomphidius. It's a mycorrhizal mushroom, grows in association with the roots of trees, and it hyperaccumulates cesium-137 more than 10,000 times the background levels. Now, this is extraordinary because the radioactive fallout falls like rain, or with rain, and the mycelium then upchannels this radioactive metal, which substitutes in the metabolism of the fungi for potassium. On the atomic chart, they're very, very close. And so the cesium is upchanneled via the mycelium over large expanses of the forest and then hyperaccumulates them into these mushrooms that burst from the mycelial mat, and the mushrooms come up for a few days. And the mushrooms become highly radioactive, you know, more than 10,000 times the radioactivity, but in doing so, decontaminates a large swath of land. Now, why would these mushrooms do this? Well, we don't really know, but a good thing that they do it. And I think it's one way of nature is being able to mend from a disaster, is that the skill sets from the biodiversity of these fungi within the ecosystem gives us an opportunity, or gives the ecosystem an opportunity to let other life forms which are not tolerant of this radioactivity to be able to proliferate. So we fast forward, and then a group of scientists at Einstein University was watching videos of Chernobyl inside the damage containment area, and saw something that was fascinating to them. They saw black molds growing on the cement walls. Now, in that environment, there's more than 1 million rads of radioactivity. This is an extraordinary amount of radioactivity. No life forms were thought to be able to live in this environment. But these molds were growing all over the concrete, and there's no other nutrients there. So they thought that was very interesting. They got samples of these molds, and then something extraordinary, heretofore unknown to science, was discovered by the scientists at Einstein University, that the melanizing fungi that have the same pigment that we have in our skin exposed to sunlight, the melanizing fungi are able to use gamma irradiation for cellular metabolism in a fashion similar to the way that plants can use sunlight for photosynthesis.
Unbelievable.
This is incredible, and because I'm involved with this TED community, I have a TED talk and a TED Med talk that are very popular. Larry and Sergey invited me to Googleplex, the co-founders of Google, and there's a bunch of brainiacs go there, a bunch of Nobel laureates. About 120 people were there, and I got to meet the leader of the Martian project going to Mars. And I'm talking to them. I go, "What's your biggest, you know, biggest concerns?" And he goes, "Oh, by far, food. We get 6 months to get to the planet with astronauts, a year on the planet, 6 months to get back. We can't haul the food. It's just too much mass. They're going to have to grow it." And I said, well, how are you going to grow it? And he goes, well, we're going to grow it. Well, we think we're going to grow it in greenhouses. I go, greenhouses in the vacuum of space? You know, how are you going to heat these, et cetera, et cetera? He goes, yeah, it's a huge conundrum. We don't know what to do. Well, this discovery from Chernobyl and a unfortunate teaching moment, we now have the possibility of using gamma radiation from the spacecraft's engines or from gamma radiation elsewhere to grow fungal foods. So this discovery may allow us to explore other planets. This could be the tipping point for the interplanetary colonization of space. And so I got real excited about this because I'm involved with fungi in multiple levels, and I thought, well, this would be perfect. We could actually grow fungal foods and then use the fungi to terraform other planets. And so as you get to Mars, then you have these fungal filaments you can put onto the rocks. And Mars is very high in carbon dioxide, and these fungi are very tolerant to high CO2. And they could begin to munch the rocks to create the soil lenses for then terraforming Mars or other planets, or creating the greenhouses on Mars where you're creating the soil. So as terrible as these disasters are, humans are really good at seeing a silver lining and an opportunity for being able to take the examples of nature. And we need to listen to nature and amplify those lessons and those successes. And when we divorce ourselves from nature, we get away from nature, then we're closeted and we're opaque to the opportunities that nature is suggesting. I believe nature is constantly calling out, you know, telling us that, wake up, humans, we have lessons to be learned here. Please be sensitive to them. See what nature is offering. And I think this is a clear example of that. So
is humankind going to be part of the remediation? I mean, you seem to have a very positive outlook on the future, but I'm just wondering if the railroad or the mining car is going so fast down the track that we can't catch up.
Well, the rule of nature is that any organism exceeds the carrying capacity of its ecosystem, there'll be a cataclysmic events, usually diseases that emanate out of the ecosystem that knocks down the offending population, the species that is out of control. I think that we are, our population on this planet is growing too fast. We're at 9 billion. I mean, 8 billion, it's the population explosion is stressing all ecosystems beyond their limits. That's why it's a terrible thing to say. I love people. I love children. But a viral pandemic will knock back the population maybe in a reset to levels that we can then be able to have more sustainability.
Go ahead.
I hope that's not true. I hope that isn't true. But I think de facto it will occur, whether we like to believe that it will or not. I think nature, nature bats last, and
she's just going to take care of it.
Yeah.
So when you were talking about avian flu earlier, it's make me smart on something here. Make everybody smart on this. Is this a specific virus, or is it a virus that can remain itself and yet, if not mutate, then adapt as we try to eradicate it? It seems like if it's a specific virus, there must be some specific countermeasure to it, but it appears that that's not the case.
Well, the antiviral drugs, the viruses quickly develop tolerances against them. So because of the diversity of viral strains, even in H5N1, there's many different forms of H5N1 that are being discovered now, and some of them are a lot more drug resistant than others. There's H3N2. That's the one that was circulating around just recently. That's the other one that Agarikon is extremely active against, H5N1, H1N1, H3N2. If you go to the magic bullet single drug approach, that's really different than having the nutraceutical approach, which gives you a platform of multiple antiviral agents in a consortium. It makes it a lot more difficult, I think. That's the reason that triple antibiotic ointments work better than single antibiotic ointments.
Sure.
It's very, very hard for the bacteria in this case to be able to negotiate a defense against three different antibacterial pathways. But so with the Fukushima The idea, and I wrote a paper right after Fukushima, the nuclear force recovery zone, and I proposed that, and it's up on the web, and it got translated into Japanese, went all over Japan, is to retire a 30-mile zone around Fukushima as a nuclear forest, an old-growth forest, which would mend itself over several generations, or maybe many generations, and using these mushrooms to hyperaccumulate the radioactivity, you could selectively go in and then harvest the mushrooms, then remove them, and then incinerate them. No one's going to complain about burning mushrooms. And then you recapture the radioactive metals through scrubbers. And this way you can decontaminate the environment without removing the soil. And this way the ecosystem can heal itself. This is very Japanese-esque, as it turned out to be. The Japanese love this idea. And we're actively involved now in researchers. And we're working with a group, we've begun dialogue with a group at Hanford, at the Hanford nuclear reservation here in Washington State to actually prove this. And we have a number of species as candidate species to see if we can use these mushrooms, which have melanin, these melanizing fungi. And then you would harvest the mushrooms, and then over time you would decontaminate the environment in a stepwise fashion. Now, this has been met with, this has been taken very seriously by top-notch scientists. I was afraid of mycophobia. They'd make fun of this, and exactly the opposite has occurred. They think this is a very interesting, viable alternative because there are no other alternatives. The other alternative is to denude and scrape up all the soil, and you're down to barren rock, and
that's
now the
bad.
Ecosystem is devastated.
This thing that was just posted, the 16th at 10:25 in the morning Eastern time, they all know, in quotes, over 5 million becquerels per square meter of soil, I suppose, the cesium-137 in Fukushima City. They're talking about problems 180 kilometers away.
Yeah, and they don't want to create widespread panic. You know, where are these people going to go?
Well, I mean, is the country, just between ourselves and the rest of the world, they're in bad trouble over there.
And they're demoralized, and their immune systems are compromised because they're demoralized as well. So this speaks to a larger picture of health. You know, when you are under assault, you know, from exposure to radioactivity, you know, you're under stress. Your immune system is also further impaired. Again, nature's a numbers game, and your health is a consequence of many factors and cofactors which interplay with each other. And so we have to look at the complexity of these situations to gain some benefit. So these viruses have really caught my interest, and because we have such interesting results now, against H5N1, flu, you know, pox viruses, and also hepatitis, I've been very much interested in oncoviruses. Now, about 14% to 18% of cancers are directly attributable to viruses called oncoviruses.
I'll tell you what, that's an extremely important point. But you have large thoughts. May I call you Dr. Stamets?
It's an honorary doctorate, but Paul is fine.
So. It doesn't matter. As far as I'm concerned, you're a doctor. I think in some ways an honorary doctorate. I think that's even more profound, frankly. Let's talk about these onco complications, and then let's get into diet. Let's see if we can remediate ourselves. Chemtrails, nuclear waste, petroleum waste. Oh, stand by. More to come. This is Coast.